You're listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information, visit abc.net.au/conversations. Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Earlier this year, on a cold winter's night in June, the ABC's Chris Yuleman just popped up on the 7:30 report to tell us something extraordinary was happening in Canberra. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was going to be challenged and beaten. The nation collectively choked on its evening meal and went, what? The reports were difficult to confirm until later that night on Late Line, there was this.
One of the key moments in tonight's extraordinary developments was the announcement that the Australian Workers Union had lost confidence in Kevin Rudd and was backing a move to Julia Gillard. Well, the National Secretary of the AWU is Paul Howes, and he joins us in the studio. Why did you do that?
Well, we've been looking at what's in the best interests of the members of our union. We know that Labor's message had been lost for the last few weeks and, in fact, months under the Prime Minister's leadership. And we think that Julia Gillard is the best option to lead Labor to victory at the upcoming election.
Well, that was Paul Howes letting us know that the challenge was definitely on. 24 hours later, we had a new Prime Minister. Paul Howes, the young union leader, was immediately identified by the Liberals afterwards as one of the unelected faceless men who did Rudd in. And Paul Howes is my guest today. I can confirm that he does indeed have a face. And he says his role in the whole thing has been somewhat exaggerated. Paul Howes is the National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, a position he's held since he was 26. He's only 29 now, but he's been right at the centre of national events like the Beaconsfield mining disaster, the toppling of a Prime Minister, and the hair-raising 2010 election. As the campaign began, Paul Howes was asked to keep a diary of that campaign, and it's called Confessions of a Faceless Man. Paul Howes, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks, Richard.
Is it a bit unfair, you copying the faceless man tag, because you were actually the only guy who showed his face that night, weren't
you? Well, that's why. I'm always simultaneously called a faceless man and a media tart. I'm probably more of a tart than I am faceless. Okay. I don't have a pretty face, but I've definitely got one.
can I quote Scott Morrison here? Who, you say some unkind things about him in your book, who's the opposition's immigration
spokesman. Not unkind, truthful.
Yes. He said, I'm quoting him here, I'm not going to help Paul Howes with his usual self-promotion campaign. The guy will get around in a skivvy soon and campaign to be the fifth wiggle if it'll improve his profile. Can you confirm you will not be running for the job as fifth wiggle here and now, Paul Howes?
Well, never rule anything out. Who knows where life will take you. But I actually ran into Scott on Monday night. I was at Canberra having a few meetings and I ran into him in the dining room and he came up to me and he said, he has got me the skivvy. And, of course, I've got my son's grown out of the Wiggles now, and I've got a Captain Feather Sword, because when I was thinking about the Wiggles, I thought, Scott Morrison, Captain Feather Sword, patrolling the high seas for these armadas that are yet to appear. And, of course, I've had a long time Twitter fights and different fights with Scott, and I suppose, quite harsh on him in the book, but I don't think unjustly so.
Who do you like amongst the? I mean, in the book, you're very much a kind of a Labor warrior in the sense you're like a Collingwood supporter in that sense. You're that kind of guy. But who do you?
That's the most insulting thing anyone's ever said to me.
Well, I'm sorry, Carlton. Is that better? Am I getting closer there?
The Swans.
Me. Okay, that's a good sign, I think. Are there any people in the opposition you actually like? You find personable that you get on with?
Look, there's a lot of people in the opposition that I get on personally well with. Politics. Probably not many, if any. But it's one of the things about Australian political life that I think a lot of people outside of politics don't understand, but also people around the world don't understand. Australian politics is very small. Australia's a small country. Canberra's a very small town. So if you're in Canberra and you're having dinner on a Wednesday night, the chances are you will end up in the pub with plenty of different parties. In fact, I write about the election night where I went to a bipartisan election party after the commentary gigs finished. But there are some people in the coalition that I have enormous respect for and I like personally, Doesn't mean I like their politics, but I think they're, you know, decent people and stand up for what they believe in.
Well, that's right. I mean, we have families, don't we? In our families, we have uncles and aunties with politics that are different to us, and we still love them, or, well, at times.
tolerate them.
Tolerate them at best, you know, that's what it's like. But is it the environment in Canberra is not really like that, though, is it? It is quite tribal, isn't it? It's there are long-standing kind of ideological differences that flow over to personal enmity, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I generally like politicians who say what they believe in. I like people on our side that stick up for their own beliefs, and I like people on their side that stick up for their own beliefs, which means I end up, the kind of the people that I like on the coalition side are normally the people with the most hard right-wing views, but I think at least they've got the gumption and the moral fortitude not to pretend to be moderates, but actually doing conservative things.
I was just going to say, you must be hard up for mates in Canberra if you have to select people who stick up for their beliefs these days.
Oh, no, that's a bit unfair. I reckon there's actually some really interesting characters down there that actually have enormous intelligence, are often sold short by the media, but... You know, I mean, thinking about coalition people, someone like, Nick Minchin, you know, from South Australia, wacky, wacky guy, crazy ideas. But if you're a hard right-wing libertarian, small government, no tax, don't particularly like minorities and so forth, he's your man, and you know you've always got him. And that's what I kind of respect about him, is that at least he's got the courage to stand up for what he believes in, even if what he believes in is wrong.
You know, it's said that most of us, you know, that we have our own personal stories and that informs our politics. And it'd be good to talk about your really interesting and tumultuous young life, Paul. You were adopted as a little kid, but your folks split up when you were quite young. How old were you when they
both did? I think I was three. Three when mum and dad got divorced.
Do you remember that at all? You wouldn't have many memories.
I have a memory of sitting on, we had this big staircase. I grew up in the Blue Mountains. We had this big staircase that went up to our house. It was kind of built on a cliff, kind of. It was escarpment. I remember sitting on there when dad left, and when dad left to go to work. And I'm pretty sure that's a memory of, it's like a memory of a memory. Sitting there with my older sister, Katie, and as dad left. But it was a pretty hard time after that.
Why? What was difficult about it specifically?
Mum didn't have any money. I think there may have been, I'm not sure the great detail of it, I think there may have been some custody issues and maintenance issues and so on. We kind of moved from house to house for a while. I remember spending one Christmas, you know, all three of us living in the back room of one of Mum's friends. Mum had great friends and she's a very caring person and well known in her community. But it was, you know, it was a difficult period, and I just remember feeling very unsettled in that period of my life. And then Mum got remarried pretty early on when I was about five or six, yeah.
That often doesn't go over too well for kids. How did that go over with you?
I had a very difficult relationship with my stepfather, and I write about that honestly because of my mother and my stepfather have recently broken up. I accept that I was probably a pretty difficult kid. I'm not backwards and coming forwards, and I was probably a little shit, to be honest. But I'm sorry, I shouldn't say like that, swear like that on radio. But I had a difficult relationship with him, and that probably was one of the reasons why I left home so young.
How about the father that left home? Did you maintain a relationship with him?
I did, and I still see Dad every now and then. But I, at an early age, I felt very alone in the world, and that's a. I'm not saying that for a kind of sympathy vote or anything, but it's just a kind of. I think it does. It has influenced my life since then, and I have a very close relationship with my mother now. But as long as my stepfather was in the picture, I found it hard to have a proper relationship with Mum because he was such a negative influence on my life.
In what way? What was it? I mean, I don't want you to sort of talk about things that you're not terribly comfortable with these things, but can you think of it, what you concluded from that, of what you didn't want to be?
Yeah, it's a terrible thing as a parent now when you see yourself repeating the habits that you hated so much about your parents, and every now and then I find myself talking to my son or my two daughters and thinking, oh my God, I just sound just like Gary, you know. And I I never want to.
We have that music
that.
In our heads, don't we? That's the thing. Even if we don't like, we didn't like it, we still have those bad songs in our heads.
It's a scary thought when you know you hear your parents in yourself. It was a very negative household, and I never felt very encouraged. I always thought I was dumb, you know, and that was kind of reinforced to me from him. And I felt a lot of competition with him for a long time over weird things, and I always was trying to compete with him, even up until recently. It's hard because I don't want my son in particular, who I see a lot of me and him, to repeat the early adolescent life that I had.
That's a hard thing. It's one of the traps of parenthood, I think, isn't it? That you're hard on your kids for the things you don't like about yourself too. That's the other thing, isn't it? You know, don't do that. That's terrible what you've done there.
It's an awful thing, parenthood, sometimes, isn't it?
None of us are qualified.
Yeah.
Were you carrying a fair bit of rage? Did you know you were adopted? Like Judith Lucy, the comedian Judith Lucy, she discovered she was adopted quite late in life because it was blurted out over the family table. I mean, when were you aware that you were adopted?
I can never remember not knowing that I was adopted. So I think Mum and Dad always spoke to myself and Katie, my elder sister, about that. I can never remember not knowing it. So I can't remember ever being told.
Since you felt alone and kind of angry, how did that manifest itself? Did you have rages as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I was a pretty angry little kid.
Violently so?
Yeah, a couple of times. I sought, you know, I'm a very social person, a bit too social sometimes. But I sought the company of my friends. I had great friends, and in my early teenage years, I had my best mate up there in the mountains, Laura, who I basically almost lived with, you know, with her and her family. But I was always kind of looking for something else.
You left home when you were 14, I think. Mm. Yeah. Mm. What was the catalyst for that, for you deciding to leave?
Well, I had some. I'd left my mum when I was, I think, 13 or 12, and then moved up with my dad, which was not a good situation. And I wanted to get out and I wanted to go home, but I didn't feel like I was welcome home because of my stepfather. So I just thought, well, I got to go. I can't live like this anymore. And so I moved into the city. I'd become politically active by that stage as well. As a trot, and I think that movement was encouraging me, and with their cult-like pattern of behaviour, was encouraging me to kind of cut your ties with the outside world and become all consumed.
So it was like joining the Moonies.
Kind of. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between some of those far-left sects and religious cults, cults of personality, but also trying to become all-consuming and run your entire life, which is a sad thing, because I realised I'd gone from a young kid who was concerned about French nuclear testing, a Mirror at all, to a committed Marxist-Leninist without really ever thinking about it, just because it became all-consuming and I was probably too young to realise what was going on.
National Secretary of the Australian Workers' Union, Paul Howes, is my guest in conversation. His campaign diary from the last election is called Confessions of a Faceless Man. Well, even though you said you were being told you were a dumb kid, it sounds like you were reading the paper at quite a young age. And were you reading history as well?
I read a lot, and I still do. And in the mountains, you get terrible TV reception. And where my dad lived, we had awful television reception. So you could kind of, if you stood on one foot and held the aerial out the window, you might get the ABC occasionally. So I was fortunate that I had a household full of books, and Dad always had a lot of books, and I used to enjoy reading. I used to like looking at maps, and but
I just love the fact that the absence of television probably saved your life in this case.
Probably. But I always like to read, and reading is very important. I don't think people can underestimate the importance that reading impacts on one's life.
At 14, at 14, what was the appeal, do you think?
I think I was closer to 15 than
14. I beg your pardon. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Was it like, here's an explanation for why you are alienated? Yeah. Was that it, or was it something else?
No, it was, I was concerned about French nuclear testing in Mirror. I don't know if you remember, that was about 95. So I would have been 13 around that stage. So I went to a couple of protests in the city with some mates. There was a big campaign on And I bought Green Left Weekly, you know, and then all made sense. I went to a couple of meetings, which I thought were about French nuclear testing, but then I got told the reason why the French are testing nuclear bombs in Mururoa is because of capitalism.
Imperialism and capitalism.
Capitalism.
Yeah. Yes.
And there was an easy answer to everything and obviously an easy solution. And when you're young and you don't necessarily question everything that's been told, you've been told by, and you've been given books that make a lot of sense, and you don't necessarily look at the rest of the world, it's easy to get trapped into it.
Still, you're at 14, 15.
Yeah.
How are you living in Sydney?
So I moved to Sydney. I got declared independent.
Legally?
Yeah, legally independent.
What? How did you do that? You go to the family court or something?
No, you? Had to go through a Centrelink process. I can't remember what it was, but you had to. I think I had to get counselling and had to demonstrate that I was irrevocably unreconciled with my parents. I can't remember the details.
That sounds horrible, actually, that process.
I think I was pretty keen to make it work because I enjoyed eating and living. So I was pretty keen to get that income. So I went to I enrolled myself at Glebe High down here, and then I discovered that if you're declared independent, you can write your own sick notes. That you, as an independent adult, you have your own guardian. So I stopped going to school pretty quickly when I lost that kind of discipline at home. I did my time in Cuba and so on, which I've spoken about before, and then. When I came back, I had to eat. I couldn't go back to school. So I lied about my age and I got a job as a bank teller at St. George Bank.
Where were you living, though, as a kid? I mean, I think you said you slept rough a couple of times.
A couple of times. And that's, I think, been over-exaggerated by some media outlets.
What does that mean? Where did you sleep?
I can remember sleeping one night in Central Station, a couple of nights. A lot of friends' couches, so I just went from friends' couches to friends' couches, you know. Eventually I got a house, so I was living with some friends in Chippendale and you know, the party kind of, you know, this was before I was in the Labor Party, when I was still a trot, you know, live with comrades and you can, you know, spend your whole life selling Green Left Weekly. And so I did that for a while, but after I started working and I became a clerk in the insurance industry, I managed to have enough income to move out with some other friends.
What was that like for you emotionally to be... On the one hand, I suppose you've moved out of an unhappy home, and that's got to be a relief at some degree. But I suppose you would have felt even more alone in the world. Or, I don't know, what was that like for you at that time?
I felt alone, but I got to say, that was a better period for me than... I mean, I regret that period now, with the benefit of hindsight, but I felt happier at that time than I was when I was in the mountains. So it was a better period for me then. And I was doing something that I thought was right as well, because I was being very active in you know, far left politics. But it was not finishing school is the biggest regret of my life. For me to get a university degree now, it requires so much years of study that it's just impossible for me to do it, and it's a big hole that I feel I have in my life.
Still, I suppose the one thing you can get from politics, and even that kind of politics, is. When you're stuck in an unhappy home, it feels like that's the whole world.
Mm.
Then you have a much larger world that you can escape to, one with more importance and one you can have agency in. So that's I can see the appeal there under the circumstances. But as you said, you went to Cuba. What took you to Cuba?
It was suggested to me that I should go to France and to Cuba. There's a thing called the Fourth International, which Leon Trotsky set up back in about 1922, I think. So I went there in Paris for a couple of months, and then I went to Cuba to this a big gathering of kind of left-wing activists from around the world, and I stayed there for a bit longer to do some study. It was a very exciting, you know, I was 15, 16 at the time. It was very exciting to be able to do this, and I thought before I went there, Cuba was the bee's knees. You know, this was the society to model the rest of our world on. You know, it was... a big adventure for someone who'd never been out of the state, really.
Yeah. I suppose when you get there, the cars look great. There's
not
good
really.
Music. No, well, no. Tell me... what
they do in the tourist areas. They don't in the suburbs, yeah.
Yeah. You became disillusioned with Marxism, or such as it was then, at that time. What was it that you saw in your months in Cuba that changed your mind?
Well, look, I was there during the special period, towards the end of the special period, which was what the government classified that era after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so very hard economic times. But it was meant to be a period of kind of political liberalisation, and there was a lot of criticism of the regime going on. That stopped halfway through. And I remember one night, we weren't meant to go out by ourselves, but I was relatively young. I became friends with some of the other kids in my apartment block. And one night, we went down to the Malecon, which is this big boardwalk around the harbour in Havana, a great place where you just, you know, drink rum and dance and listen to great music until 2 or 3 in the morning. One night I was walking home and we weren't meant to be out and we're kind of breaking curfew with some other kids from the apartment block and we're walking back and I saw five trucks pull up in one particular street and take out an entire apartment block just into the back of trucks and off they go.
What do you mean, take out?
Everyone in the apartment block came out, filed very quietly into the back of trucks and off they travelled. I don't know what the story was, what was going on. And it dawned on me after a while that the blockade is used by the regime as the way that they excuse themselves for their gross corruption and heavy hand of the state. I mean, I first thought some of these things have to be curtailed because of the blockade and American imperialism, blah, blah, blah. What I discovered is that the blockade actually serves as a useful purpose to the regime, a corrupt regime. And like many of the other deformed communist states around the world, a semi-royal regime. You know, the baton has been passed within the family, as it has been in North Korea. I mean, North Korea is a monarchy now, and Cuba's not far different from it. I think because they've got great music, they can dance well, fantastic rum and great cigars. Many people in the Western world kind of idealize Cuba, and they're a bit sexier than the North Koreans. But to be blunt,
it's a police state, isn't it?
It's a prison island. Yeah. It's an imprisoned island. I don't think the Americans have done themselves any favors with the blockade. I think it's a silly policy. Because to be honest, I think if you opened up trade with Cuba, it'd only be a matter of time before those people overthrew their government. But it's terrible. It was really shocking to me to see something that I believed in for all that was another Stalinist dictatorship, and that's what really led to me questioning my own belief set.
I was in Eastern Europe during the fall of the Berlin Wall period, and it was interesting to talk to locals there. They'd shake their heads at Westerners who were enthusiasts for the regimes behind the Iron Curtains because they had to actually live with it. Did you have those conversations with Cubans, or were they too frightened to talk to you about the way things really were and how it was like living with a secret police?
Remember, Fidel Castro spoke out against glasnost and perestroika. He had a breakdown in his relationship with Gorbachev. So he's a hardline Stalinist. And people don't think that. I mean, there's an amazing new book that's come out recently called 1 Minute to Midnight, which is an account of the Cuban Missile Crisis for the first time using Kremlin records. So it's the first time that there's an account's been written with both American records and the Kremlin's records. And it's a great book. And in it, it documents in great detail, using Russian records, the fact that Che Guevara and Fidel Castro wanted nuclear war. They saw a nuclear war would ultimately lead to a victorious communist movement which would spring up through the ashes of a blackened world. And if you read some of the cables that Che Guevara sent to the Soviet leadership, you think, how could you walk around with this guy in your T-shirt when he was willing on the destruction of the world, the death of hundreds of millions of people simply because of his deformed ideology? The glorification of the Cuban regime around the Western world because they're kind of the sexy version of the communists is odd when you consider that they were far more hardline than Brezhnev, far more hardline than Khrushchev, and far more hardline than Gorbachev.
It reminds me of an anecdote from one of the international meetings with Mao, which Mao attended, where he said, bring on the imperialist nuclear war, let's have it, let's sort it out once and for all.
Yeah.
And an Italian communist said, well, what about my country? We'd all be destroyed. And Mao said, who told you Italy had to survive?
Well, you know, I mean, it's... what did Mao say? Shoot one, educate 1,000. And that's the mentality of a lot of these...
Still, this is your worldview. This is the thing that, you know, introduced you to the wider world, and you're seeing it all collapse around your ears. What happened then? Did that lead to a kind of crisis in you, or did you quite easily walk away from all of that, Paul?
No, because, as I said, it's a cult-like movement, and it's very hard. I mean, you know, a lot of these young university students that join up on O-Week don't realise what they're signing up for, and it's hard to leave. My whole life was dominated by that movement, you know, selling the paper, going to meetings, organising protests. But after a while, I just started to question my own belief set. And in the end, I just said, this is rubbish. This is a dead ideology that a few good people, well-meaning people, are trying to keep alive without actually looking at the rest of the world and realizing that that experiment was tried and it failed comprehensively.
Why did you join the ALP as opposed to just walking away from politics altogether, or indeed joining the Liberals, for example?
Well, I still believe that I'm a social democrat, and I became a. Eventually, my belief set evolved to think that the market, when appropriately harnessed and regulated, can do enormous good for working people. Well,
that's what you think now, but is that what you thought back then?
It was an evolutionary thing, you know. And so I didn't join any party for a little while. I wanted to be involved in politics. I thought about either joining the Greens or the ALP. In fact, there was a guy called Bob Gould who runs a very famous bookstore in Newtown, who was one of the founders of that trot movement that I was involved in, that convinced me to join the party because he said that you need government to be able to affect change. And I wanted to change the world still, but I thought you should do it through democratic means.
And what happened when you joined the right of the ALP? How did Bob Gould feel about that? Was he all right with that?
He wasn't happy, but the reason why I joined the right was because I no longer believed in socialism. I didn't want to join a faction called the Socialist Left because I wasn't a socialist. A guy called Michael Costa, who's not highly thought of these days, but a man who I deeply respect for being a thinker, like me, had been a teenage trot, spoke to me once when he was Secretary of the Labour Council and explained that the enormous good you can do for the world through reform.
What was your first job in the union movement then, Paul?
Well, I was a member of the party for a while, but eventually I was offered, and I was an active member of my union at the time as well. I was working in the insurance industry and I was a delegate for the finance sector union. But eventually I got offered a job at the Labour Council, which is a peak body for unions in New South Wales. And I did a variety. I was the glorified shit kicker in the office, but I did a variety of things. I got to organise the workers at the Olympic Games, which was an amazing experience. And then I was put on a task force looking at the conditions of out workers in the textiles industry in Sydney, and that's what really gave me the passion for organising workers.
That sounds like sweatshop land to me. Do we still have sweatshops in this country? Knowing that we do, in fact, yes, but that's the question, yes.
I can take you a 5-minute walk from this studio and show you sweatshops in Surry Hills. I was doing that work for the union that represents those workers, the Textile Clothing and Footwear Union. It was a horrific and eye-opening experience for me that in this country, in this day and age, you have slave-like near conditions taking place in our major cities. To me, it reinforced the value of the union movement and why organising workers was actually such an important role for progressives to play in this country. And that's what gave me the passion to want to be an organiser, and I asked the AWU to give me a start as an organiser.
How connected are those sweatshops to illegal migration?
Not as connected as you think they would be. So a lot of these workers are here legally, particularly in the textile industry there. You know, refugees or come on family reunions, but have little to no English, have little to no skills, and so take up these menial tasks in the clothing industry. The worst examples were sometimes you'd go into a fashion shop. So I'd be a well-known designer who out the front would have the design studios, and it'd all be champagne and caviar and lots of darlings, you know, kind of ab fab style situations in the front room, and out the back you'd find 10 little Vietnamese women hunched over sewing machines working for $4 an hour, working 12-hour days in appalling conditions.
What are you able to do for people like that?
Well, that task force was set up by the state government. So it was one representative of a union, one of WorkCover, and one of the Department of Industrial Relations, and we were given special right of entry powers. So we didn't have to give any notice. So we just were able to walk straight in to survey the conditions in the industry. Out of that, the New South Wales Labor government set up a special piece of legislation basically tying the employment conditions of those out workers to the master contractors. So and that has led to a substantial improvement in the textile industry in employment conditions. So it shows the value of unions in organising these areas. It also shows the value of Labor governments to assist unions in doing that.
Meanwhile, on your the family side of things, you know, you managed to escape from this very unhappy sort of childhood family life. What's really striking about you is how quickly you wanted to set up your own, Paul. You were a dad at how old were you? Were you when you became a dad?
Sam was born 2 weeks before my 21st birthday.
That's a lot of responsibility. Why? I mean, were you in a hurry to start a family? That's the question I want to ask. I don't know. But I don't know. Are you pleased about the fact that you could start a family so young in life?
Yes, I am now. I don't think I was jumping for joy at the time. Read those boxes. You know, it's not 100% guarantee. But I wouldn't change it for quids now. But my wife is an amazing woman, very mature woman. I mean, she had a very good upbringing, very supportive home, wonderful parents. She got 99.9 on her TER, amazing results there, and was destined for great things and still is doing great things. She had Sam. I was working full-time for the union, not earning much money. It was a pretty, a low-paid union organiser by ourselves trying to support Lucy and Sam at home, but she managed to finish her law degree during that time, and we've got a wonderful family now, but there were some hard years there that we had to get through, but family's important to me, and I'm very fortunate to have such a great family. My kids are my only blood relatives that I know, and that's important to me as well, but I wouldn't change any of that at all.
Do you ever try and find your biological parents?
I've started half the process and I haven't completed it, not through any hesitation to do it, but I just, to be honest, it's a very bureaucratic process which I haven't got to.
Bob Ellis, your friend, wrote something very amusing in his most recent book where there was a moment where you suspected that that your dad might in fact be Tony Abbott. Is that entirely possible?
I thought it for quite a while because it was when the news first came out that he had a son that had been adopted. You get an information sheet from the adoption agency. I was adopted through the Catholic Adoption Agency, and it said, my father was a law student at Sydney University called Anthony, who's involved in politics. And it's around the same time. In fact, I found out later that there's a couple of years difference between me and the guy who works for the ABC who I've met, actually. I met him.
Tony Abbott's son anyway, is it?
No, it wasn't Tony Abbott's son. He's a lovely fellow. I met him at, he was filming a meeting I was doing in Launceston. We ended up having a night on the tiles together. You always find these kind of instant bond with other adopted people. But that was...
Was there a moment, though, where you thought you might actually be the son of Tony Abbott?
Oh, I did. I did for a little while. I kind of thought, I've got big ears and I'm not as fit as him, anywhere near it. But fortunately, I know now that it's not Tony. It would have been great Christmases.
Excellent. Yeah, lively and robust discussion, I think, is the euphemism, isn't it, around the family table. Yeah.
I think Bob's living out a fantasy there, though, because for some reason he loves Tony Abbott, and me and Bob get on very well as well. So I think he loved the idea that bit coming true.
You got an award for that last night, which I'll tell you about later on. You joined the Australian Workers Union as Bill Shorten's deputy, and not long after that there was the Beaconsfield mining disaster there. And how did you hear about something had happened there? Because I think Shorten was away, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. I was working for the union for quite a while before I became Bill's deputy. I was working in the New South Wales branch, moved to Melbourne. It was the first time I was acting secretary, actually, and I'd been acting secretary for 12 hours, and my Tasmanian branch secretary in Wakefield rang me in the middle of the night, said there's been a rock fall at the Beaconsfield gold mine near Launceston, three members trapped, probably dead. You should come down in the morning which is the normal thing for a national secretary to do. You go down, and I was acting secretary at the time, you meet with the members, you talk to management, you set up the safety inquiries, you make sure the payments are going through, then you represent the members' families in terms of organising appropriate workers' comp payouts and enough cash for them to survive. That is a very standard thing that, unfortunately, I have to do all too regularly. The difference with this one is that the entire world's media was focused on it.
Well, that was when it was discovered that some of the miners might be alive, wasn't it?
And
I suppose there was that point when it looked like no one had survived that. And, I don't know. It's a bit like, in a way, I suppose your role is to deal with the families. It's a bit like you see very raw grief firsthand. What was that like for you, just to deal with the families? At that time?
It was a really look. Initially, this might sound a bit cold. It was a normal thing. It's sad, but it was a normal thing. Unfortunately, you know, we have 14 hard rock miners that lose their lives in Australia every year on average. So that's not unusual for us to be dealing with this issue. There was a bit of media attention on it because I hadn't found the bodies. So there was a few cameras set up around town. Beaconsfield's a beautiful little town. So you noticed that around town, did a few interviews and all that type of stuff. The day Larry Knight's body was found, I remember all of Winnebago started packing up, so all the TV channels started flying home and leaving. And I had to deal with the coroner then and deal with Jackie, who's Larry's widow, and Shane, who's Larry's brother, who was down from Queensland at the time. And then trying to make sure that we continued a search and rescue effort rather than a retrieval effort. And not many people know this, but the coroner who came and met with me and said, well, this is a retrieval process now, not search and rescue, and we had to fight very hard to make sure it remained a search and rescue effort. But also, I mean, I thought they were dead, and you're dealing with the members, and these are the generational miners, so they're most of the families of Todd and Brant were union members and have been part of the union. Wakey, our branch secretary, came from the mining industry. It's a very close-knit community. It was those days, which were the days that weren't on TV and not everyone was watching, those about 4 or 5 days were probably 4 or 5 of the worst days of my life.
I've seen footage of you from that time, and there are moments when you seem quite emotional about it all, and quite so. And then there are moments when there's kind of white-hot anger, if you like, cold anger from you. Mm. That's because of the media and the media's role. What was it? How bad was the national, international media's behaviour during the time of that time in Beaconsfield?
Shocking. Shocking. When people were misreporting. So I told the family, I'll give you an example. I told the families only to listen to the ABC. Don't watch 7 or 9. Just listen to the ABC, you'll get some good news there. There was all these myths being perpetrated by, you know, talking to someone drunk at the pub, this is what's happening. All of a sudden it's being reported as news. I remember AM ran a story one morning which was completely wrong, saying that Todd and Brant were walking around outside the cage. Now, the families were overly concerned about that because they knew if you're walking around outside the cage, the chances of a second rock fall are huge and you could be crushed again. So I immediately went over to the ABC, who was set up in a little hut. Tim Cox was doing the breakfast show there for ABC Hobart and ripped into the current affairs reporter, who I get on quite well with now and will remain nameless. But that type of stuff was shocking. But the worst was the invasions of privacy. And I remember one afternoon being outside. I was minding Todd's son, Trent, and being outside in the backyard playing with him. That was a hard day because early I discovered him digging a hole, trying to get to Dad. And you got to understand, this mine is in the centre of the town. Todd lives directly across the road from the mine. So you can see the shaft. And in fact, where Todd and Brant were trapped was almost directly below Todd's parents' house, Nobby and Kay, digging a hole to find his dad, which was just gut-wrenchingly awful. But also then realising that we are being photoed from about 5 different angles. You know, everywhere you went. And for us, I mean, I stopped speaking to the media after a while, but you were followed everywhere you went. And it was an awful, awful period. And the best guy in town was a guy, a bloke called Marshall, who ran the Riviera Hotel in Beauty Point. He kicked all the media out of the hotel and said, go sleep in your cars, and gave all the rooms over to the rescuers, which was the right thing to do, and then barred them from coming in and drinking, which was great because it meant we meant we had one little area where we could get away from it. Shorten was doing a lot of media on it, but those of us that were doing the work, it was a tough period.
Still, those guys came out of the mine, they came out in style, didn't they?
Well, Todd and Brant still know how to do things in style, but and they're great guys and wonderful families. But too many people think of Beaconsfield as a good news story. It's not. It's Larry died, and people forget about that.
Paul House is my guest in conversation. His campaign diary is called Confessions of a Faceless Man. Let's get on to that now. During the course of the Rudd government, you'd been critical of the Rudd government. Did Kevin Rudd let you know of his displeasure with some of your comments?
Oh, yeah. You always knew where you stood with Kevin. A little bit like a kind of a 15-year-old girl. You know, a lot of it would translate through evil stares and nasty comments. But if you dare criticise Kevin when he was Prime Minister, you knew it. I think he bagged me in question time once, and certainly in my meetings with him, would make his displeasure known if you were questioning his views on refugees and so on. Which is why I think there were so few people in the caucus or the ministry prepared to stand up to him. And that's a narrative that the Conservatives have latched onto now, which is, well, if he was such a bad Prime Minister, why didn't you know and never say anything to him? Well,
that's a good question.
Well, he wouldn't allow people to say it to him. A conversation requires two people, the person speaking, the person listening. And if the person isn't listening, you're not having a conversation. And that's what his biggest problem was.
I suppose the shocking thing about that night was that we had a Prime Minister who'd been elected. He'd won an election handsomely and on expectations of change, as new Prime Ministers are often elected. Mm. And on that night, we suddenly discovered, it was really quite shocking, because we suddenly discovered that the vast majority of his own party, who'd been telling us what a terrific guy this is, we've made him leader and he should be your Prime Minister. It was like, and we got that news from you pretty much. It was like, it turns out this guy's no good after all. We've got to get rid of him. Sorry,
I was
about
very
that.
Flattering of Kevin in that interview, by the way, but I lied.
But yeah, well, that's right. Mm. Yeah. And do you understand how shocking that was for the Australian people to receive that news?
I think if you could do all this stuff again, it was handled poorly. But it happened. And I had a view, and I know other people had a view, if there was a normal leadership challenge takes months. Disquiet, leaking, resignations, look at the coalition, the way they do it, complete catastrophe for a few weeks, and then new leader, on you go. That wasn't an option, because frankly, there was an election due any moment, which we were going to lose, and lose convincingly. And secondly, I have a firm belief that the moment that anyone gave a whiff of a challenge, he would have been in his car on his way to Yarralumla calling the election. But people need to remember that we live in a parliamentary democracy. We do not live in a presidential democracy. The people vote for the ALP. The only people that voted for Kevin Rudd were the people that live in his electorate. And the leader of the party needs to govern with the support of the majority of their caucus. He did not have that. And that's why that change took place. That might sound harsh and authoritarian, but it's just the reality. That's how democracy works. And Clark and Dore had this fantastic fake interview with Tony Abbott on the Friday on 7:30 report about the leadership change. And they said, Mr. Abbott, thanks for coming. What do you think about Kevin Rudd's removal? Abbott responds, well, terrible, nasty, faceless men, coup in the middle of the night, terrible thing for the Australian people. And then the question is, well, Mr. Abbott, how did you get elected as leader of the Labor Party? He said, well, essentially what happened was that the clouds parted and the large booming voice said, Tony, go forth and lead, and you shall. Yeah. So, this is politics, and it happens on all sides.
I suppose it's a problematic thing, because there are two leaders now, the ex-leaders, that the Labor Party isn't too proud of having put forward. That's Mark Latham, who's not exactly your newest best friend in this book. I think you've exchanged comments in various journals and over the years, and now Kevin Rudd. It seems rather odd to have this process whereby you wonder about the caucus itself and their ability to elect a leader and of character that they feel confident they can stand behind.
These are two very intelligent men, very talented men. Kevin Rudd's an amazingly talented man who had the capacity to lead. So did Mark. The reason why I'm dirty on them was not the way that they led. I'm dirty on them what they did afterwards. Think about Mark Latham. They gave him everything he wanted, and then he thought he would punish them for doing that. Similar thing for Kevin. The caucus giveth and the caucus taketh away, and you have to deal with that sometimes. And I don't like rats. And that's what I see in those two guys. I look at the way Simon Crean handles himself. Now, he had an enormously hard job as leader of the Labor Party. Kim Beazley, enormously hard job as leader of the Labor Party. But both of those men have always gone on to serve the party that gave them the opportunity to lead once upon a time. Look at Bill Hayden, the same story. Those are men who have integrity, who may not like the caucus's decision, may not respect it, may not even like or respect the leaders of the party that replace them, but accept that they got given the opportunity, it was taken away and it hurts, but they'll continue to play in the team later on because they know that that's the right thing to do.
The 2010 campaign, which your book is a diary of, is a pretty horrible campaign. I think you can, the consensus formula on that, and I happen to agree with it, is that, that leaders were timid, they were shy, they gravitated towards the centre. There was not much put forward in the way of interesting policy. And what there was covered really badly by the media. The media's coverage was about as worse, I think, I've ever seen in a campaign.
Everyone was guilty, the parties and the media and the people.
Yeah. So why won't we, will we have that again? I mean, we don't seem to have solved that problem, do we, of timid leaders, a media that's always covering things. I mentioned this in the past, that where I think Tony Abbott was trying to make a major policy launch, but the distraction of Mark Latham's arrival. Well, who was being distracted? You know, the media was being distracted. They say, oh, well, you've distracted us. Mark Latham distracted us. We can't be expected to cover. And then finally we have the election, and it's just put in the hands of the independents. And then they conduct a proper democratic audit, which we should have had during the campaign. It's terrible.
Well, sometimes the nation's media can be a bit like my my 6-month-old daughter. And if you get a squeaky toy and squeak it in front of her, they'll, oh, look at that, look at that. And, you know, this election we had Mark Latham. But I'm confident things will change because the right conversations are taking place about long-term leadership at the moment.
Some of the best analysis, I think, of that election has come from Bernard Keane at Crikey and George Megalogenis. And their view is that Labor, most of the Labor's leadership was elected during the early years of the Howard government and went through what was, for them, the traumatic experience of the 2001 election. And they're still spooked by John Howard. They're still intellectually, emotionally, ideologically on the back foot. That the Labor's leadership team concluded privately amongst themselves after the 2001 Tampa election that the Australian voters were intolerant and greedy.
But Bernard Keane has written some very, very interesting stuff on this. He's an amazing writer, Bernard Keane, actually. It's the only reason to read Crikey. In fact, I wish you'd leave and just set up the Bernard Keane report because then I wouldn't have to give Crikey any money. But that's... Never underestimate the amazing psychological damage that 11 years of a successful coalition government did to the Labor movement. A lot of the answers to the question, why did they elect Mark Latham and Kevin Rudd in the first place, can be answered by the immense psychological damage done by the coalition. Because we were so desperate, so desperate. And Work Choices felt, it wasn't just about the unions. I mean, Work Choices was about killing the entire movement. Howard was very deliberate, and you know, credit to him, he knows how to get what he wants, and he was very effective at doing that. And I think we still haven't actually learnt the lessons of John Howard, which is sticking to your guns, developing a narrative and what you think is right for the country, and throwing caution to the wind about the polls and newspaper reporting, actually just sticking to what you believe in. And that's what Labor needs to do. And I'm pleased that Wayne Swan's piece in the Oz today is very interesting. And I think that that's heading in the right direction.
Well, we're hearing calls from leading Labor figures like yourself and Wayne Swan for more ideas, ideas, without being told what those ideas are. When you talk about ideas, you call for new ideas. When you think of that, what kind of ideas do you get you excited about the future of Australia?
That's a bit... Look, I'm calling for a culture of ideas where we have debate about anything. And that's what I think we need.
Well, we have that already, don't we?
No, we don't. Not at all. We have... You know, you said that before when we were talking about the election coverage. It wasn't a debate of ideas. It was a debate about who won the most days. The Rudd style was win every day. If you win 365 days in the media cycle, you've won the year. If you win 1,000 days, you've won the election. That's wrong. I think Labor's done some good stuff, but they haven't developed the narrative about it. Why is a strong economy and low unemployment important to working people? Why is taking action on climate change important to keeping our economy strong? Those are the narrative questions that need to be answered, and there needs to be a developed, clear, consistent message so people understand when they're voting for this party, that is the overall narrative that they're voting for and the philosophy that drives it. I'm confident they can do that. But on the other hand, I also think that we as a movement need to be far more open and engaging about dissent and diversity. That's not happening at the moment, and that's why I'm saying calling for new ideas. It's not that I particularly want one. It's just that I think if you read, if you discuss, if you debate, if you develop new ideas, sometimes you're going to develop those gems that can transform a country.
Is it Paul Keating's analogy that, you know, running the country is like riding a bike, you've got to keep pedalling or the bike will fall over?
Mm.
Paul Keating, you know, in that great period of Labour ascendancy during the last great period, always throwing out new ideas, ideas. It backfooted the opposition. And the same thing happened under the Howard government. Such ideas as they had were brought forward, and it always knocked the opposition about. That's what governments can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they will. I mean, there's a lot of negativity around at the moment about the way the government's going. But I think the government's doing the right thing. They're not responding to the polls. They're not responding to the daily media cycle. They're thinking, and they're taking a longer-term approach. I actually think that 2010 has been such a damaging year for Labor that we need a new year to be able to start afresh.
You've done that in opposition? I mean, it seems like the time for soul searching shouldn't be in government. It should have been in opposition.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it used to happen in opposition, and it stopped in around 2006, where the quest for power became all-consuming, and it was power without glory.
How about your own ambitions, Paul Howes? Do you want to enter Parliament one day?
Look, I would never rule it out, but I'll say this. I intend on running again for re-election in my union in 2013, if they'll keep me, which I hope they will. And I don't know what I'll do afterwards. You know, once upon a time, I had no greater ambition than going into Parliament. I always wanted to go into Parliament. But now, where it's far easier for me to do it, I don't know that I do, because certainly I wouldn't want to have to go down there and compromise too much. And I think maybe you do have to compromise if you go down there. So I'm going to stay doing what I'm doing because I get to do real things. I get to think about policy and talk about it, but I also get to practically make work to improve the lives of our 135,000 members in the AWU. And what I do after that, I don't know.
It's been great having you on Conversations today, Paul, on radio. Of course, listeners can't tell whether you have a face or not, but I can affirm that you do have one. It's been great to speak with you, and thank you so much for being my guest, Paul.
Thanks, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.